Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. In the fireside room this afternoon is Cliff Hall. Today's session number is HAC 2001-2, and it's titled Faith and Healing. Let's listen in.
Rather stressful day for all of us, and especially for the folks back east that are going through the tragedy of the losses there. The topic for today is faith and healing, or faith and medicine. For those of you who weren't here yesterday, I'll make the same disclaimers that I did yesterday. I'm neither an ethicist nor a religious scholar or philosopher. My background is in medicine and critical care, and more recently in geriatrics. So my perspective, it might be a little bit different, and I don't profess any great skill or special expertise in ethical issues, or certainly not in religious issues. Before we start, I'd like to tell a little story. Yesterday I told a story about a 90-year-old woman who wanted to die, who had a pacemaker, wanted to have it removed, and how we dealt with that question and the ethical problems that it posed, and what kinds of principles one might use in terms of coming to an ethical or at least a reasonable and satisfactory decision process. Today I'd like to pose another question, a little different question, but to pose it by also telling a story. But instead of a 90-year-old woman that wants to die, it's a 40-year-old man that wants to live, who was severely injured in a climbing accident, suffering major injuries, including a fractured neck, multiple broken ribs, serious blood loss, and who was in a very inaccessible area. So if this person is to survive and to recover, it's going to require an unbelievable coordination of search and rescue, of resuscitation, of transport by helicopter to a medical center, of neurosurgery, of ventilatory support, being hooked to life support, feeding tubes, tracheostomies, and then a long rehabilitation. This person is a very religious person, one of great spirituality, who's devoted his life professionally to helping others and personally to helping others, has a strong religious and spiritual family, belongs to a community that's very spiritual and very supportive and very religious. And when these various elements are informed of the injuries and what this person is facing, respond with wishes, with prayer, with spiritual thoughts. And the question that I pose is this person more likely to survive and to have a complete recovery because of the spirituality that he possesses himself, that his family possesses, and that his society in which he lives possesses? And if so, if he really is more likely to survive and make a recovery, why and how? And I don't want to answer that question right now or try to answer the question. We'll just let it kind of percolate in the back of our minds while we go through sort of a discussion about faith and medicine. And maybe when we get to the end of this hour and we have the chance to interchange some ideas and some thoughts, we might be able to answer that question. Yesterday we talked about ethical principles. And we came up with five, and they're listed there. And I just will mention them briefly just to bring people who were not here yesterday. We talked about service, the service ethic, which underlies medicine as a predominant and current theme. And that implies competence, compassion, and respect. Talk about beneficence and non-maleficence, and that's to do good and not to do harm. We talked about the easier phraseology of that. We talked about autonomy, an individual's ability to make his own decisions, and the implications of that from the medical profession, the obligations or duties that include truth-telling, full disclosure, and obtaining informed consent. And then we talked about justice, or distributive justice, of how we balance the needs of the many and the needs of the individual, and at what level that can take place. We also talked about how these series of ethical principles form a framework in which we can deal with almost any issue in medicine, ethical problem, and get it back down to some very simple principles. And we can see sometimes how a given conflict or a given quandary in medicine or in our personal lives can come down to competing goods, where an individual and the needs of an individual's autonomy comes in contrast or in conflict with the needs of society. We did a little discussion about metaphors in medicine. We talked about how we talk about medicine is how we view medicine, what we expect medicine to be. We talked about individuals losing their health or being stricken by disease, sort of implies a divine intervention of some kind. We talked about the military model of the battle against various diseases. The physician as a technician, and the medicine as a business. We look at what medicine really is, or how we view medicine, and we probably all view it a little bit differently, but basically, the way I view it, and I'm taking the liberty of talking a little more at the beginning here, and then we'll open it up to more discussion. But medicine is really a body of knowledge that's entrusted to professionals to share with patients, with the goal of achieving or promoting health. And then we get, how do we define health? And then health is more than, as we know, more than just the absence of disease, but it's really the ability to seek and pursue life, liberty, and happiness in the sense. And health can be looked upon as an individual goal for each and every one of us individually, or as a group or society or a community, or even on a global perspective. And I think more and more we have a responsibility to think of medicine and providing medical care as having a wider responsibility than just to an individual. In my lifetime, it has been, and in all our lifetimes, what has happened in medicine has been absolutely astounding and almost unbelievable, and certainly unbelievable to someone who would have lived in the early 1900s and just suddenly came back on the scene. Traditionally, medicine has been passed down from generation to generation by an oral tradition based really on authority. That's what the elders said, and that's therefore what we will do, and that's what we will believe. It was based on anecdote, and to a certain extent on trial and error. Certainly the Eastern medicine was very much based on trial and error, mixing together various forms of herbs and extracts from plants and animals, and some of these worked and some of them didn't, and often the exact active ingredient wasn't known, but it was done by trial and error. In the past 100 years, and certainly in the past 50 years, the scientific method as it applied to medicine has just totally revolutionized medicine. It's hard to believe that 100 years, just over 100 years ago, that aspirin was introduced. It's absolutely hard to believe that in 1943, the year I was born, there were no antibiotics. There were sulfa drugs, but there were no antibiotics. Penicillin was not available. It's just inconceivable that all this could have happened. Anesthesia, surgery, ventilatory support, CT scans, MRI scans, microsurgery, and gene therapy. You've heard about that. Gene therapy and pharmaceutical changes in the future are going to be just absolutely outstanding. And one of the things that's going to be truly revolutionize medicine and surgery is going to be computer-assisted microsurgery. And it's going to raise a whole question about how we train surgeons in the future, because does a surgeon really have to go to medical school? If the way he's going to operate, these are going to be like computer games. And it's going to be like our kids and grandkids who operate these things and shoot down invaders and things. That they're going to be the people who are really going to be best capable of handling these these computer games that are actually controlling micro devices that are inserted into the body to do surgery. And already this is being done on a number of things. Some of the cardiac microsurgery that's being done with little probes put in the body is just absolutely astounding. And that's another whole revolutionary aspect. So the scientific approach to medicine has been absolutely astounding for what we've developed and our ability to, and it's been reflected in longer lives and lower death rates, but it's also been reflected in an embracing of the scientific attitude by the practitioners of medicine to movement that has de-emphasized the other part of the healing process, which is the personal touch-based concern, the art of medicine, if you will. And in response to that, there has been a movement in this society and in other developed societies to complementary and alternative forms of healthcare. And it's really been, I think, in a response to the failure of scientific medicine to fully appreciate that there's another side to individuals, that we are not just biologic models, that we are spiritual people, that we are religious people, that we are emotional and psychological people, and that we fit in some, that we see ourselves in some kind of role in society. And we haven't really addressed that as well or with any kind of the emphasis that we should. So we've seen this increased interest in complementary and alternative medicine, and that has involved a whole variety of things, and I suspect that most of us here have used one form or another: chiropractic, homeopathy, naturopathy, exercise, relaxation, meditation, nutrition, herbal supplements, right down the list, and probably most of us have at one time or another used some of these alternative methods. And in addition, we have looked to faith as a strength and as a potential healing factor. And I think a real question comes down: do we deal with faith and religion in the same way we deal with other scientific parts of medicine? In other words, is it testable? Can we really test whether prayer works, or whether faith works, or whether a religious person has a different medical outcome or a different response to a disease? And I think that raises some very, very important questions that I think we can discuss here. So it's really a question: do we trivialize religion when we treat it or test it? Do we treat religion? Should I list religion along with chiropractic and naturopathic and herbs and exercise? Is it just one more thing there, or is it something entirely different? Is it really a way of existing, or a way of being, or a way of relating to the world and to all its own complexities and uncertainties? Or is it just one more little aspect of behavior that we can categorize? And I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think I know how many people might feel about that. And certainly, if we can establish scientifically, if we wanted to test, if we could establish that scientifically that medicine was good for your health, should we prescribe it? Is this something where an almost flip kind of response? If you call me and I would say, take two aspirins, say a prayer, and call me in the morning. Have we really reached that point with religion? And does not religion have its own intrinsic worth and value? Well, I wrote up on the top faith and medicine, and the connecting, is it faith and medicine, or is it faith as medicine? or is it faith in medicine? And to each of those, they really mean very different things, as I'm sure you know. And the faith in medicine is almost lighthearted, but at the same time, I think we all recognize that if we don't have confidence in the medical system or in the physician that's attending us, we're not going to do as well as we would otherwise. Well, I just want to open it up. Does faith play a role in medicine? Does faith play a role in healing? And if so, how does it, and what have been our collective and individual experiences with that? Yes.
Yes, I do believe faith has a great deal to do with it. I think as a retired physician, I believe there's more than just healing as far as medicine is concerned. I believe in holistic medicine, which encompasses diet, exercise, and the spiritual quality. And I think holistic medicine has a great deal to do with the prevention of disease as well as the healing of disease.
How do you think that works?
I'm not sure how it works, but I think it has an effect on the immune system and upon one's whole emotional and relations with other people. And I think it has a great deal to do with the ability of the body to prevent disease as well as to heal it.
Any other comments?
I think it's important because, you know, like communication nowadays, you know, medicine is getting to be so specific, you know, you have a technician for this. There's hardly any communication with the patient, you know, and with faith, and to really, you know, have a one-on-one with somebody that is like spiritual, you know, and I think like somebody that's an alcoholic or something, you know, the 12-step program, you know, go to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a spiritual-based program, and it seems to be what works.
Good observation. Yes?
I think that one of the things that I felt troubled about as well as thrilled about in the advances in medicine is that so often the exploration has been to find the active ingredient in something, which when found often does not do what it's supposed to do, especially with regard to Asian medicines, herbs and so on, because there's so much that we don't know, and we're total people, and there's such complex relation between our mind, our body, our spirit, I don't think it's testable. And yet it's there. I used to be a nurse, and I saw a patient die from a gallbladder operation. It was just an ordinary gallbladder operation, no more serious than an appendectomy. But she didn't want to live, and so she died. And that, I think, was an issue of her spirit, her spiritual.
Yes.
One of the things that I find difficult in this whole problem,
go right ahead.
Is that so oftentimes we talk in terms of faith being an aspect. Another aspect of the scientific method is the method including faith, something we can work at and do and those kinds of things, and leaves off the concept or the belief and the reality that comes with that belief of a God who does something. And so oftentimes faith does not take into account that God, as we talk about medicine.
So you really see a
a distinction between faith and perhaps an intervening divine spirit or power that's separate from anything that we would do medically. Independent.
Well,
and not testable.
No, not necessarily. But I think in so many instances, God is left out. And even then, though we talk about faith, we're talking about just another way of looking at things instead of our own way of looking at things, instead of taking into account the reality of this God who's there and who has something to say, who has something to do, who will, I believe, do something.
But an intervening God.
Yes.
He was.
Although kind of uncomfortable, I think, with the idea of putting faith to the test, there have been a number of studies done to do that. The reason I think these studies have a scientific basis kind of thing to them is that most of them have been initiated by physicians. The faith community has not wanted to do this, so physicians have done more of these. And one of the largest ones tested cardiology patients who received prayer anonymously, and it was a blind study, and it showed that the patients who received prayer required fewer days of hospitalization than those that were with similar conditions, and less pain medication. So, and there have been some efforts now by the National Institute of Health to replicate the study, and I'm not sure whether or not
it has been produced.
Yeah. But, and the numbers in the initial study were not large, but significant. So, but there are a number, I think, you know, the studies number in the thousands now of examples of where faith has shown to be effective. Faith is a broad term, and as he was saying, I think, you know, we end up with faith in what, you know, are we talking about prayer or just sort of a belief in the physician or mind body? Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of spirituality is a big issue here, but my experience in working in hospitals has been that those patients, and there's so many dangerous ways of looking at this. I think we have to be real careful not to say that, you know, if we pray for someone, they're going to do better, and those that don't get prayer, God doesn't care. But I do think that those people who request or who receive prayer, at least they go through their illness in a different place than those who just go through without the benefit of faith.
I'm very troubled by the fact that our medical profession at the present time seems to be dealing mostly with symptoms and really not ignoring the problems that are causing the symptoms. At least that's my feeling. And quite often the solution is more or different medicine rather than looking into other conditions that might be causing the problem. And I'm speaking from my own personal experience. That is a
criticism that's been leveled, and the exact opposite criticism has also been leveled at medicine. Is that we're so intent on finding the riddle, solving the riddle, or making the diagnosis that we are ignoring the patient's concerns and symptoms in the process. So that's a two-sided criticism.
The patient's problem, what's wrong with the patient, I don't see that the doctors that I've been seeing have been looking for the root cause, but they've been trying to find the medicine that will fix the symptom. That's my complaint.
Well, I'm sure that's been your experience, and I don't question that that's been your experience. My only point there, and I refer this to the other physicians or nurses that are here, there are many root causes of illness, we can go back to the way we view health and what health means, and whether it's one of the things that we have to be very careful about is if we can demonstrate that people who are religious or who pray tend to be more healthy than people who don't pray, are we therefore saying if you get sick it's because you're not religious enough or whatever? So we stop putting the blame, to go back to some very basic causes why illnesses occur. Some are genetic, some are environmental, some are the interaction of those things, some are behavioral kinds of things that we do in terms of why we get the diseases that we get. If you worked in a mine where you were exposed to high doses of radon, you might very well get lung cancer. And that's the root cause. But the treatment is going to be either removing your lung or treating it or doing something for the cancer. We can't go back and attack the root cause. But the process of, if you have lung cancer and you're coughing and you're having pain, is the treatment just to get the medicine to give you pain relief, or is it to actually try to treat the cancer and reverse whatever these processes are? And that's basically the question I think you're asking. Peter, you have any comments about that?
I was going to comment more on just the idea of trying to prove faith. I mean, to me, in my own spirituality, I don't want to say it's offensive, but it just seems like an irrelevant argument to me that we have to apply the scientific method to faith that kind of is contradictory to my definition of believing. That it doesn't really matter to me whether we prove that scientifically that prayer is working or not. And that's, I don't think you should be praying for the sole benefit of better health for yourself. I mean, that's not what I think my purpose, my religion is. As far as what you were talking about with looking for physicians in general, not looking for the roots of problems, I think that is a problem with our healthcare system in general. I mean, I think that we tend to look at symptom treatment. But I think that our system is changing to a more of a public health and preventative system that is trying to look for some of the preventable things that you can do to change your health. So I mean, I think there has been that problem in medicine with just looking at the symptoms and trying to look for it quick, make you feel better. But I think things are going a little bit the other way now.
I feel that the scientific approach to medicine has made great advances, as you point out, Cliff. But I do think that, as you indicated, we've been distracted from other important aspects of medicine, feeling that the scientific medicine is the cure-all, and that takes care of every aspect of a person's health. And I use health as opposed to illness. And I do think that the reason that alternative medicine has been increasing so rapidly is that the patient, oftentimes in our current medical system, where the scientific approach is the only approach that's used, the people don't get what they need or want. And so they'll go to somebody who will listen to them, who conveys to them that they care, that they show compassion. That takes time. In our current medical system, I think part of it is the economic structure, where medicine has been made a medical commodity. It's been thrown in the marketplace.
Yes.
So,
in fact, it's going to be busy this afternoon.
Yes, busy this afternoon, so we're stuck. We'll do that another time.
The bottom line is
that we need to take
a dollar. and satisfying the stockholders.
Maybe go over and see if we can get a really long tape measure and measure the BC.
There is a great deal more to a patient's health.
Oh my gosh! You guys are unbelievable.
The fact that people are going and searching someplace else, I think itself indicates that in some area where medicine is only concentrated on the scientific aspects of it,
so we're down to it.
That it's lacking.
We're at 10, what? 10?
I have sort of a practical question in response to that. I'm in my third year of medical school at the moment, and one of the things that we as students struggle with going into medicine is the reality that in a lot of ways it is a business now, but that most of us are not in it because we want to do a business.
Sure.
And so, and we talk about faith in medicine and we talk about holistic health, and one of the things that we always look for
awesome.
Is concrete suggestions of things that physicians can do in that little bit of time we have that would help patients. Ways that we could bring faith up, ways that we can bring more holistic ideas up.
Oh, so there is, that's 4 o'clock today, is that?
Yeah. No, her others aren't calling this
one. I think your point is really well taken.
Cool.
I do awesome. Witness to right. patients. When I used to see patients,
it was very short, and
there were 5 people waiting to see me.
Oh yeah.
And
that's why today's must be after something.
I didn't want to give that patient the impression that I was pushing him out the door. And I would always made it a point.
On that page. Okay.
Yeah. It was hiding. Hiding.
Okay.
We're gonna take this back,
I
right?
I'll take that in.
And I listened and I wanted to help them. And so it was always when they came to the door. I'll see you next week, or I'll see you next month. Right. I'm not very much to know how you're doing.
Yeah.
This is a thing that Cliff has talked about.
There we go.
Covenant of trust between the physician and the patient. And this is the thing that you'll find that many people are very critical of medicine in general, but they're not critical of their physician. Special relationship with the physician. But this has a lot to do, I think, with healing and has how people feel about their future and their health.
Do HMOs push a lot? I know an office manager of a clinic, and they keep track of the length of time doctors see and how many patients they see, and they are reprimanded if they don't see enough patients.
Sure, that's another point of the time constraints. But to get back to you raise a real issue, and that is how does one deal with a patient's spirituality or religion or beliefs when you have a relatively limited amount of time, and where your background and your own spirituality, your own religion may be very different. I think one thing that physicians have to be very, very careful of, we are experts in applying technology, we're experts on a lot of things, and in giving advice and knowing which drugs and what doses and things, and making the proper diagnosis, et cetera, et cetera. We're not necessarily experts on religion or faith, and there clearly is an overlap and an interaction. But I'll at least go out on the limb and say that I think physicians have to be very, very careful about saying about how they bring up this whole issue of faith, and it's a very slippery area to get involved in where you either pray with your patients or ask the patients if you want them to pray, because what you're praying for and what they're praying for and how sincere that is and how much of it is an act. One has to be, I think, sincerity in the patients. Patients are pretty, sort of like a dog knows when you really like it or don't like it. We're not really insensitive to our physicians. And I think we can relate, and we have a sense of when the physician's being honest and really is caring and is concerned about the individual. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a detailed, at least in my opinion, a detailed exploration of where their faith is. That may come over a period of years of getting to know patients. One of the real problems in medicine, of course, is that, and your comment about HMOs and about everything else, is that how many people have a physician that they have known for 5, 10, 15, 20, or 25 years? I think it used to be in the small communities where populations were relatively stable, they had that kind of relationship. And now with so much specialization, so much movement, so much fracturing of families, it's unusual to have that kind of long-term relationship with someone who really has been through a number of crises with you. That's one of the most beautiful things about practicing medicine in one area over a long period of time, is that you might be able to develop those relationships. Yeah.
About 25 years ago, I came to Holden and went to a session like this, which was titled Bioethics. And it impressed me because the speaker said what we have done is separated the spiritual characteristics of people with their physical characteristics, and that every person is a whole person, and this is forgotten if you just treat it like a car that has something broken and needs fixing, or someone comes in, my knee hurts, and then you begin working on the knee. This is a person, and so that there has become a separation between faith, as if it's separation of church and state, there's a separation between faith and medicine. And one suggestion was that we should get back to recognizing that a person that's in the hospital is still a whole person, and their spirit needs treating as much as their body. And his idea was that we should regularly have religious figures such as pastors, chaplains, if you will, in the hospitals and clinics, so that a doctor who had seen the person as a person who was partly spiritual, or that was a characteristic, would then turn to the chaplain for his advice in this case, if it was necessary or if it seemed helpful. Instead of just saying, well, that medicine doesn't work, try this one. You know, there's another dimension, in other words, that our culture has kind of neglected. That's all I'll say, but that's what it's worth.
That was well put, and I think hospitals are more and more, almost every major hospital I'm familiar with does have a chaplain service. May have one, two, or many chaplains, plus parish leaders throughout the community regularly come to the hospital to visit their parishioners and provide some of that service and attention.
But I'm not aware of that when I go to my clinic for a doctor's appointment. No one says, the chaplain is just down the hall if you'd like, or doesn't call the chaplain in. There's no recognition of the spiritual quality.
I don't say this to be flippant, but my experience with my veterinarian is so much better than my experience with my doctor. And I think there's a reason for that. And I think that, just to answer the question about it maybe, is when you take your animal in to see the vet, aside from the fact that you're dealing with people who just love these little animals and you can't hear what's going on, is they can't tell you what is wrong. And so everyone in the room, myself as the dog owner and the veterinarian, is forced to, see how how's his mood been? What's he been like? How has he been acting? And the whole approach is looking at this little being as a whole, because they can't communicate with you. And you're just in touch with them as a whole. And so when I say, gosh, he's been moping around, that means something to them. And I think that veterinarians, because they have to, are focused into the spirit and soul of the little animal as well, because you need to do so to treat them. And I think that if my doctor were to treat me that way to a certain degree, he or she could get more in touch with me. They could sense if I'm a spiritual person or not. They could sense if I'm a religious person or not, and kind of treat the whole person. And I really do think doctors could learn from vets, because if I don't have a vet that acts that way, boy, I dump them. Interestingly, I don't dump my doctor if they treat me that way. I don't know why that is, but...
I do
think that it's because they have to look at the animal that way, and I think if doctors looked at people that way, they'd sense more about their whole person.
I think that somehow over the years in the United States, we've created a social relationship between physician and patient that I think is a little bit strange. When I was a nurse many years ago, doctors were put on such a pedestal. And of course, people who are put on pedestals are easily knocked down, and they have to be strong within themselves to handle that. But the other side of that is that people have become so dependent on the doctor for answers instead of going for answers themselves and using the doctor as a consultant, for example, an expert in the field. And I think many times we put an undue burden on physicians, expecting them to have answers where answers are not possible.
That's an interesting point about how much one uses the physician as a consultant or the physician as a more paternalistic authoritarian figure who will really have the answers for you. And my experience, and I'll ask others, is that that really is a patient-dependent view, because there are individuals, and it's also a generational difference as well, in terms of how an 80-year-old person views his physician versus how a 35-year-old engineer who has internet access and can review all the literature about his symptoms before he even shows up and has reams of all the latest articles. It's really very different, and one has to, as a physician, has to recognize almost from the beginning what the patient is expecting from the relationship. And you almost have to define that relationship, especially if it's in your first few visits. Your comments that you felt the physician was oriented to symptoms and not to the root cause, there's a communication problem right from day one or from the first moment. And your comments, it's the same kind of thing as, I'm here, doctor, because I need some advice, or I'm here, doctor, for you to take over the management of my body. Now, those are two very different things, and yet that can happen one right after another in two consecutive 15-minute appointments. And it's obviously, if a physician feels very uncomfortable with one or the other of those people are kind of not treated so well. They're shunted out of the practice, or the patients are not happy and they leave and go elsewhere. So that over a period of time, physicians tend to attract the kind of patients who relate best to them and to that kind of practice. But it really is a problem from the other side. From the physician side, is being able to recognize in that relationship what the expectations are. And if those are not made clear from the beginning, it's very difficult.
Yeah. Well, the doctor has to recognize a person there. I mean,
absolutely.
A person has a body that has an immune system, and that has habits, and that has intelligence, and that can know. You know, and so if the doctor only treats the person not as a person, but as, say, let's call it a case. Mm-hmm. I've got a cardiac case. Yeah. Instead of, I got George. You know,
absolutely. We go right back under service. It was competence. You expect competence. You expect some compassion. You expect respect as an individual.
It's a mental attitude.
Of course it is.
That is observable in doctors. And I've not had much experience with doctors because I've been very healthy all my life, so the last few weeks when I have happened to have to see one, I've seen a terrible change, and I don't think it's doing anybody any good. So we should really think about the wholeness of a person as important, and that you're not just dealing with a case that has all these number of symptoms and needs these various medicines.
How do you tell that to our third year medical student here, so that when she goes out into practice a couple of years from now, she's going to be able to recognize that person as the full, complete person? Now, this is still,
it's going to do more like this lady's veterinarian does with the dog. I think that's the answer.
Is there a sense that pediatricians practice medicine is very close to veterinary medicine? Is there a sense that pediatricians do better than adult physicians?
May I tell you a story of a pediatrician that just happens to fit? Mm-hmm. I had a very wonderful pediatrician for my children. And I don't have very much faith in medicine as a scientific,
That's the faith in medicine, right, as opposed to...
I have faith in people and very many doctors, and this doctor earned my faith by his actions in this case. Antibiotics were very new. And my son was suffering from frequent earaches and sore throats. And the public publications were saying how dangerous antibiotics were, and that it's all right if you take a lot of them right at once, but don't take them slowly for a long time or you'll get immune or bad things will happen. So I went to the doctor for the earache of the child, and he prescribed sulfa drug to be taken regularly over several months or weeks. And I said, "Doctor, I understand that that's not a good practice because I've read this and I've read that. So explain to me." And he said, "Well," he said, "I am your doctor. Pay me for giving advice. But I am not God. If you don't want to take my advice, you're perfectly welcome not to." And he said it in a little, he was a young doctor too, but he had lots of children. And I smiled at him and I said, "Doctor, I pay you for taking your advice because I think it's good advice, but all I want is an explanation of why what you're telling me is different from what I've read." And so he looked at me strangely, and then he took the time to recognize my question and answer me, and he gave me quite a nice little lesson about the difference and what my question was. And I had no problem giving the pills that he recommended to my son. And I had him for four children, and they were healthier than most of the kids on the block because he knew how to treat them. So I think that's what we're getting at, is the doctor is listening to the drug salesman and the pharmacist, but they're not looking at the very person sitting in the chair across from them and seeing what that person's worries are. Now everybody's worries are different. Somebody's worrying about the bill, how much is it going to cost, and somebody's worrying about something their grandmother had, and other people are worrying about whatever they're worrying about. But they've got to start looking at it as us as people, not a person. I won't talk anymore now, I said.
You spoke very well. Any other comments, and specifically as it relates to faith and health, or faith? We've talked about emphasizing, I think the points have been made very, very much that there's a responsibility for physicians to really deal with the patient as a whole, that there are many parts and many facets and aspects of an individual and not just the biologic problem at the time. And that if we don't identify with that, the relationship is not going to be as strong as it might be otherwise, and maybe the therapeutic process will be impaired because of that. Certainly, if you're angry with your doctor, you think your doctor's not, doesn't care about you as a person, your likelihood of doing well is going to be impaired.
Yeah. I think that there's a mutual responsibility, though. It isn't just all the doctors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
this lady was talking about how she insisted upon having an explanation, and so she got it. So, you know, it's a to and fro. I sometimes feel, I was put into remission from leukemia a few years ago through an alternative treatment. I had an oncologist who made me furious, and I kept getting worse and worse and worse. I went through the alternative treatment, and I went into remission in a year. The difference was the oncologist was treating me like a nobody who didn't know anything and who had no knowledge, and he did not seem to have any knowledge about strengthening my immune system. I went to this Oriental medicine practitioner, and he empowered me. I felt like I was participating in my own healing. And whether that produced the remission, or whether the herbs and the acupuncture and the yoga and the counseling and all that did, I don't know. But suddenly I was looked at as a whole person of value. And somehow this relationship, I mean, to me that was a question of faith. It was faith in myself, or in God in me, is the way I felt about it at the time. I felt empowered to do something about my situation instead of being helpless.
Important point.
Well, unfortunately, some people don't have, you know, the assertiveness or the resources or whatever to assert themselves in the system. And I think sometimes it's scary to see some, I'm a social worker, so I work at people who go to the emergency room every time their kid coughs, you know, and then have these billions of dollars of bills because they don't know how to muck through the system and how to get a doctor who will work with them and empower them and all those things. And I had a medical crisis when I was 2, and I had the same doctors from 2 till 23 when I couldn't be on my parents' medical insurance anymore. And I had relationships with those people and people who would explain things to me and all that stuff, and I feel like I had an education and things like that to work with that. But for 5 years, I didn't go back to a doctor because I didn't want to start over or start new. It was almost 5 years. And just I'm starting to get connected again, settled in Oregon. But I'm amazed at how much I didn't know. I mean, coming back in the system and learning about my medical conditions and things like that, that I just went to the doctor and did what they told me to do, and I didn't ever research or educate myself on what I could do outside of my doctor visit, you know, or outside of, you know, it's my responsibility to do my faith, build my faith and my, you know, incorporate that piece into that because that's important to who I am. But that might not be important to my doctor. It's important to me to get a doctor who does relate to me as a person, and it's my responsibility to find a doctor that does that. And if he doesn't do that or she doesn't do that, then I need to find another doctor. Sometimes some people don't have that freedom or that that choice, or the support, I guess, to assert themselves or to find those things. That I think it's a hard part of our system right now.
Pete?
I think that it's not just one side or the other. I think you made a really good point that there's something that both the physician and the patient need to work on. And I think that both sides are kind of going at each other, like each one has to do their thing and not the other side. Physicians still, part of it is, a huge part of it is language, and just the way your idea of physicians looking at patients as just a series of problems is true. I mean, I still catch other physicians, they'll say, bring that foot in here for the x-ray, or bring the heart in here, and we'll, you know, and I'll say, well, you mean you want the rest of the patient too, right? You know, and so part of it's just the way we look at it and the way we've been trained and just the language is a big part of it. But I think also patients need to realize that it's a really daunting task for a physician to learn about a patient. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're given 10, 15 minutes sometimes to have a new patient come in, and we have to learn their history, what their family is. We have no idea what they're like in the community, especially if you practice in an urban area where you don't live in their community necessarily. And then you're expected at the end of this time, it's 10 to 15 minutes, to help them make major decisions about their life and their health. It's
well,
a very daunting task.
Add 5 minutes to every appointment.
Well, yeah.
Talk to the person for 5 minutes.
Well, you're right, and that is a big part of it. But even, you just have to understand that it is a very daunting task. And I think just as we should be patient and listen to you, there has to be some understanding from the patient side too that we're stumbling through this too and just trying to get to know you. And if anything you can do to help us, well, and I realize that, yeah, we need to take more time. And the system, that's part of the system that our country has decided to take. And I don't agree with it, but it's a tough system to work in for both sides.
I'm sure.
I think both sides need to work together to change that system.
I have something of which I will pass out around here, or you can pick up before you leave. It's called the Patient-Physician Covenant, and it really deals with some of these issues about the mutual responsibility and what the responsibility of a physician has to his patient, as opposed to the old Hippocratic Oath, which we talked about yesterday, and about some of the do's and don'ts and prescriptions and thou shalt and shalt nots. But try to get back to not so much, or maybe we don't want to get back to it, but with respect to what the physician-patient relationship is, but whether faith really has a healing potential. I mean, can we do this either independent of physicians or just in parallel to? It may be nice if you had a physician who believed in the same God and went to the same church, belonged to the same community. That might be a real binding influence, that you'd have these other connections. But by and large, that's not going to happen. And I don't think it's going to happen in this society, at least not in our time, that you're going to expect that your physician is going, you go to any major medical center, you're going to find physicians that have trained all over the world with all kinds of different backgrounds, very different experiences, different, entirely different religious beliefs. And to think that that physician maybe grew up in Egypt and is a devout Muslim, and a wonderful physician, and you're very happy with that physician, treats your heart disease or your pancreas just perfectly well, but to think that that physician is going to somehow relate to your Christian beliefs or your Jewish beliefs or some other kinds of thing, that's maybe just asking way too much or expecting way too much. And the question, you may decide not to have that physician, but you don't want to either cut off the science and technology. And so the question is, can you get this service from the hospital chaplain or from your own church and develop the spirituality and the faith aspects independent of your medical practitioner? Yeah.
I think what I'd like to ask of the physicians is more the respect for their different patients' beliefs and time and a knowledge that that's an important part of the practice, that that's part of their healing, part of their wellness, part of their total health, so that it doesn't come in conflict when you go to see your physician, so that if the physician is someone who really respects my beliefs and tries the best they're able to get to know me, that's all I really would want. Not necessarily someone who practiced that part of me.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that we need the physicians to be the one who delivered the prayer. But they need to be able to respect that, so that if I'm going into surgery sometime and I say, my pastor's coming to visit and bringing me communion and whatever, I'm not quite ready, can we allow a time for that? Whatever. Then that's a respected thing. So it's those kind of issues that come up more than, and not going, well, I'm sorry, you know, we're just on such a tight schedule, we don't have time for that kind of thing. You know, it's just, and getting to know the person to know if that is important. It might not be. You know, there's a lot of little things like that, and I just think it goes back to that service ethic where the physician needs to pay attention to those things.
I agree with that. Is there anyone here that thinks that religious people or people who have faith or belong to religious communities are less healthy or than someone who doesn't? Or do you all believe that it makes no difference, or do you think it makes a difference?
It makes a difference.
There is lots and lots of observational data that hasn't established the reason why, but there certainly are associations between individuals who belong to church groups or who regularly go to religious services or who identify themselves as being spiritual or religious. Clearly have lower death rates from a variety of diseases, clearly do better when they go to surgery. They have a higher survival rate. It's really pretty impressive. The issue on intercessory prayer, in other words, if the study was one of the studies, there have been several studies, they have been presented by supporters of intercessory prayer as being conclusive. They have been severely criticized by other people as being unscientific, or that the controls are not adequate, or that the measurements are not adequate. So they really haven't answered the question. And it comes back to the question that Peter raised earlier. Should we even be trying? Should we even be trying? Well, the bell went off. We're going to go back to that very original question that was raised at the beginning with that 40-year-old man lying out in the snowdrift and people praying and people, some imploring some kind of intervention, some quietly praying and hoping that Peter, I gave it away, Peter will have the strength to survive and make a recovery. The question is, you know, did that make a difference? And if it did make a difference, how? And do we really need to know how or why, or is it really an important question? And I just like to quote, to close up today's things, on an inscription on a pulpit at the Grotto of Our Lady of Lourdes, and it says the following. And this relates to how do we explain how healing might take place. And it says, for those who believe in God, no explanation is necessary. For those who do not believe in God, no explanation is possible. So thank you. We're going on tomorrow, we're going to begin a discussion on end of life issues. There will not be a session on Friday, so there's going to be a session tomorrow and another one on Thursday, and we'd like to concentrate on end-of-life issues and some of the decision-making that takes place and the philosophy of taking care of older folks as opposed to younger folks. The question was raised today about the treatment of symptoms. There are some eminent physicians who believe that beyond a certain age, the emphasis should be on symptoms and quality of life, not necessarily just on prolongation of life. And that's an interesting discussion. Do we really take care of geriatric patients differently than we take care of people younger, and should we be? And how do we get into the whole question of autonomy and justice and individual rights to make decisions at the end of life, on end of life issues? And we'll specifically talk on the Thursday session about the Oregon experience with assisted suicide and how that relates to end of life issues, faith, religion, and morality. So we look forward to that. I have a few handouts for those who would like to look at these. One is called
is Religion and Medicine. It was an editorial in the Annals of Internal Medicine, Archives of Internal Medicine, published in August of this year, so it's right up to date. I also have a consumer report on spirituality and health. And the and that's a very consumers sometimes is some very excellent things, and a few copies of this patient physician covenant, which is I think in many ways the updated modern version of the Hippocratic Oath, and that would be if you haven't read it, you really I'll save one for you.
I recommend this book as well too. It's a beautiful book by a woman named Rachel Naomi Raymond. She's a physician. Works with mostly with cancer patients, and she wrote a book called Kitchen Table Wisdom that talks about faith and healing. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you for your participation.